This is The Money on RN, online and via podcast. I'm Richard Adey. All those chocolate bars, all those chips, all that bread and cheese and sausages and vanilla slices, they're adding up to too much. But how much? And how does the cost of obesity compare to alcohol or tobacco? Paul Freitas is Professor of Health Economics at the University of Queensland. And it's complicated.
The things we can know is how many people have health problems, for instance, because of tobacco. So you can look at hospital records. You can see, okay, how many people have lung cancer and how much of that will be tobacco related. And you can add that up and you can call that the cost of tobacco. And people have done that. The prevalent estimates of the cost of tobacco, for instance, are in the order of $10 to $20 billion per year in Australia. But the amount of taxes, for instance, we get from tobacco is also in the order of $10 billion per year. And what is different about tobacco is that it makes people die relatively younger. So a lot of their retirement funds are not taken up. So to a certain extent, at the moment they stop being productive for the community, they're more likely to die off. And this has not been estimated in Australia, but these kind of effects have been estimated for other countries. So it makes it very tricky to say what the real total cost of something like tobacco are.
So it's a similar situation with alcohol as well then, Paul?
Very much a similar situation with alcohol, yes. And alcohol is even trickier. So again, the cost of alcohol, the direct costs in terms of, you know, road accidents that you have, people coming into hospital because they've drank too much, and alcohol-related diseases, for instance, to the liver, they've again been estimated to cost maybe around $10 billion per year. But again, the amount of taxes we raise of alcohol is in the order of $10 billion a year. And alcohol, even more so than tobacco, has a very strong social effect, right? It is the main social lubricant in our society. And so there's huge benefits of alcohol in terms of social interactions in our culture. And I don't actually even know of a study which tries to estimate that, but politicians don't dare go near banning alcohol, for instance, right? Never mind what the health costs are. People will go out of their way to have it anyway, and that it's impossible to prohibit using it, despite the Americans having tried it once.
Oh, yes. What's clear from the ABS numbers is that tobacco use is declining, or certainly the percentage of Australians who smoke is declining, mm-hmm. and fewer Australians are drinking too much, so more than the prescribed 2 drinks per day, than there were 5 or 6 years ago. So these two are relative success stories. Why do you think that is?
Well, yes, tobacco consumption has been declining throughout the Western world for a couple of decades now, and the prevalent story on that one is that this is due to increased social stigma, increased government pressure against tobacco. And the social stigma is obvious, right? Because tobacco has a clear, what economists call, negative externality on others. So if I smoke, you suffer from my passive smoking. Government has started to be very much invested in trying to prevent you from smoking in public places and in bars. And that has made smoking more of a taboo thing to do. And so this has gradually, over the decades, whittled down the number of users to maybe 20%, 15% in Australia. And the number is very similar for UK and for lots of countries in the Western world. So tobacco use has gone down because of social pressure and, of course, because we've increased the cost a lot.
What about alcohol, though?
Well, the numbers for Australia have been coming down from a relatively high plateau, but we know that relative to other Western countries, alcohol is a reasonably large problem in Australia, and particularly binge drinking is a large problem in many of the Anglo-Saxon countries relative to the, for instance, mainland European countries. But even the binge drinking, right, we know all the excesses, we know that, you know, the dark side of people can come out, but it is also an inhibition lowerer, and that is something that we do want in society. So there again, the total cost and benefit from a societal point of view are very difficult to calculate, and I don't even think that anybody has tried. I've not seen studies where we've tried to get at the total picture on alcohol usage.
All right, well, let's talk about obesity, because it's the big one, which is a terrible pun, but it's it can't be avoided, because unlike alcohol and tobacco, the numbers are all going the wrong way, aren't they?
The numbers are all going the wrong way, and there's no silver lining in sight, right? There's no obvious amount of taxation that we get out of obesity. It's going up throughout the Western world. It's also going up throughout the urbanized world in the third world countries. It is clearly a preventable health problem in the sense that we know how to stop it, you know, if you eat less and exercise more.
One of the things you said earlier was that obesity doesn't kill you quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You could more or less expect to live almost as long as you would otherwise.
Yes, and this will surprise us. When I first started looking into this about 10 years ago, based on American data, I first couldn't believe the data. The slightly obese people were actually living longer than normal weight individuals. And, you know, you then start looking into the further medical literature on this, and there are some stories as to why that would be true, i.e. if you have more body fat, you're able to weather long periods without a lot of food better. And so you're better able to overcome particularly nasty diseases which knock you out. So there is a preventative aspect of obesity which counteracts the negative aspects of obesity and your health, such as to do with, you know, more pressure on your arteries and your respiratory system. So on balance, unless you're very obese, the current finding is indeed that you live about as long as normal weight individuals, and that indeed the people who live the longest are slightly overweight. And from a health cost point of view, this is bad news, in a sense that these people cost more, they use more medicine, there's all kinds of preventative medicine so they don't die of heart attacks and arteries and this and that, but it means that they will need that health care for a long, long time.
Well, we've discussed already that alcohol and tobacco are taxed. They, in fact, raise a lot of money for the Treasury, and they raise a lot of money everywhere they are taxed. Would it help to apply a sin tax to food, to processed food?
Sin taxes have been tried in various places because, of course, the blame game has been on with obesity. People are looking for easy scapegoats, and they've, you know, caught on to soft drinks at school or the prevalence of fatty food in the vicinity of schools. But the various experiments that have been done have so far come up with zip. If you, for instance, start to ban soft drinks from school, children will go outside of the school to buy it anyway, or parents will give it to them, right, in their lunch packet. And of course, when you think about the thing that makes you fat in terms of food, which is sugar, fat, and protein, then these are also essentials of life. So you would be taxing everybody so that some people don't overeat, but you would be taxing all those people who, as it were, have a normal, healthy diet. And hence, to a certain extent, it's a very blunt instrument and has not been found to work all that well, because if you think of the long-term trend, food prices are now incredibly low from an historical perspective, and so our ability to, as it were, afford to be obese is now quite widespread across the population, and the price of food would have to go up astronomically for it to be really too expensive for people to be fat.
In fact, it seems it's the poor who are increasingly obese because food is so cheap.
It is, and this has, of course, been blamed on the notion that fattier forms of diet are cheaper. But that is a bit of a nonsense, because it's always cheaper to eat less, right? Whatever diet you have, it's always cheaper to eat half of it. And so, yes, there are a couple of puzzles as to why obesity has arisen so much, and one of them is that the poor have more of an obesity problem, though the obesity problem goes throughout social classes. And one of the most remarkable things is that it's the older cohorts, the people who are now in their 60s, 50s, 60s, it's the prevalence of obesity amongst them that is particularly telling, because, of course, they didn't grow up that way. When they grew up, obesity was still a heavy taboo thing and was very abnormal. Almost half of them have become obese. That is very telling. This is not because of habits learnt in childhood. It is for other reasons that this has happened. And from a health point of view, from the individual obese point of view, the costs are not big enough, really, to make them care enough. Because you can live a relatively long and productive life whilst being obese, it's not clear that the costs are there to motivate people enough.
What about, I suppose, changing that cost structure then? Many of us have medical insurance or health insurance now, and it costs a lot of money. But what if it cost a lot more if you were obese?
Well, this is certainly the thinking of economists, and I've been saying this for a long time, that because this is very much a lifestyle choice, it is a little bit unfair to ask of the rest of society, well, half of society who is not overweight or obese, to essentially subsidize the healthcare costs of the people who are obese and overweight. So in order to align the incentives with the cost, it'd be better to have the medical insurance being able to differentiate on the basis of BMI or obesity. Now, in the case of, for instance, the US, that would make a huge difference. It would make a difference of $3,000 per year per person who's obese. And also in Australia, the estimates vary from between maybe $1,000 to $2,000 per person per obese per year. And there again, hence, we could indeed use these tax instruments so that at least it's a user pay setup.
As you say that, though, I'm thinking, if a government of unprecedented political courage brought this in. I think what would happen is that a lot of people who got the letter from their health insurer that their premiums were to go up because they're obese would say, well, that's it. I'm not going to have health insurance. And then we would end up picking up the cost in the public system again.
Well, it depends how you set that up, right? So in many places, some form of medical insurance is compulsory. And so whilst there is a market for which kind of health insurance they can choose, they can't choose not to have any. Or you can indeed go into the American system whereby there's a kind of queue waiting for the public services, right? So there's a free public service if you go into the emergency room, but there's a queue there. And that means you get served very late and of lower quality. But these are political choices. And as you say, it is hard to envisage the political courage to the degree that you say 30% of the population that they have a problem to which they should pay and the rest not.
Paul, you don't sound enormously optimistic about all this.
No, but I'm not all that pessimistic, because when I reflect on it, this is a problem that our society probably can live with. But at the end of the day, you know, people who are obese are also living productive lives. They can also still have warm relations. So maybe we should be a little bit relaxed about this. Yes, our fatter neighbors cost us more, but, well, we've got to spend our money on something. And you can also see the other side of this, that this creates a lot of jobs in our economy.
Paul, it's been really interesting. Thank you very much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure, Richard. Thank you.
Paul Freitas from the University of Queensland. You can find out more or send us an email from our homepage. Just go to abc.net.au/rn. That's it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy and Melanie Christensen. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Addy.